Well, good morning, everybody. Hands up if you were here yesterday, oh, look at that. Well, there's a little revision in the Jenga tower at one point, but we'll start in a different. So, well, welcome back. We can't have been that bad. Look, we are dealing with another heavy topic, but again, we're going to do that a little bit with stories, some of our own stories, cultural stories, and engaging around it. And we are going to look at, how do we get to the point in our culture where we've had this vote around assisted suicide, where pastoral care and politics are colliding. But as Jeremy said, he's already rooted it in his own story. I will do a little bit of that. This is very real for people. Somebody actually said yesterday, I really appreciate they appreciated it yesterday, but didn't feel it could come today because this is a space that they're navigating just at this moment. So we recognize the stories, but also the politics of what's going on. So we'll try and wrestle with that. But I do want to begin with a story. I was out running along Jericho Beach. There's beautiful mountains in the background. Ahead of me was Douglas Copeland's City of Glass, the city of Vancouver. And we were back in a city that we loved to holiday, but also to study at our old college, Regent College, my wife and I and kids. And I ran along a little place called Alma Street, and my pace was quickening as I was coming in to end, a few hundred meters to go, and our Airbnb was just ahead. And I clicked the watch at 5.6 miles, just under 7 30-minute miles. Most importantly for me, 600 calories burned, which meant I could go and get a lucky donut and a coffee at a 49th parallel, my favorite place. There were 4 days left on our trip. We had so many things still to pack in. I kind of hit the latch key at the back of the garden to come into the garden space to this basement apartment we were staying in. My wife is on the phone, and she's handing me my phone. And I'm like, honey, I'm really sweaty. I'm just back in from this run. I'll ring back. It's my brother is on the line. And she's like, no, that's not an option. And it becomes clear. And everything goes a little blurry for me in that moment. My dad has had a huge seizure, a suspected stroke. It's not good. And so we have that back and forward of the next hour. It becomes clear we're getting a flight home. And I wrote the first draft of the eulogy for my dad's funeral on the way to London. The words flowed easily. He was a hero of the faith to me, and a hero in work and in life. He loved Jesus. He spent his time discipling many others. When we landed in London, it was clear the news was bad. We'd spent that 9 hours out of communication, and we got the short hop back to Belfast. But something happened in that flight, and it turned out we weren't going to the morgue, but actually to the ICU. My dad had rallied a little bit, and so for the next 4 weeks, he was in hospital as he recovered enough then to go home. And we got a few extra months with him, and we're so thankful to God for that. Now, he wasn't the same. He was there, but he wasn't the same. He was ravaged by a brain tumor. His body was failing. And everybody wanted to avoid talking about death, but he wanted to stare it straight in the face. Stripped away of everything, his love for Jesus was coming through. And so he wanted to see everybody. He kind of lined up all these conversations. We acted as his PAs, basically, for a couple of months. If you didn't know Jesus, he wanted to know why you didn't know him. And if you did know Jesus, he wanted to know what you were going to do about it. It was an accelerated version of the conversations he's always had throughout his life. He couldn't remember names, like Jeremy, often mine. But he knew which question to ask which person. He seemed to know where they were spiritually and what he was going to push into, even if he couldn't remember their name. And he held on till his 78th birthday and then declined very quickly over a matter of days. And we went through that process. We shaved him and washed him and dressed him and fed him and cleaned him as best that three boys who are trained in things like law and business can do. It was certainly an undignified experience all round, I would say, for everybody, but we did our best in those moments. And we were very fortunate to be able to do that at home with him. He wasn't in significant pain for most of the time, but he wasn't able to care and tend for himself. And when he died again, we were fortunate to be able to gather around with him. And it was a thin space as he breathed his last, that moment where heaven seemed to touch earth. And we were able to be with him, sing with him, pray with him at the end. A year later, my mother-in-law went through a very similar but much more strained version of something, the challenges of distance there, the challenges of a different form of cancer. Her experience much more painful, much less fight, and a kind of different battle. And each of you will have stories around this. This is a very real thing. We are all going to experience death. We have all navigated probably already with family members and some of that, and we're aware of that. And so we bring personal stories in. But we also, our culture is telling a set of stories around this. And so I am going to return briefly to the Jenga box. So this is a moment of revision for some yesterday and something brand new and exciting in this multimedia, action-packed, game-filled presentation. But I do think, again, the cultural stories are shaping who we are. The bottom blocks here at the bottom are about these kind of foundation stories as to who we are. And we're in a meaning crisis as a culture. What is my purpose? What is the meaning of my life? And we used to hold some general truths about who we are and who the world was and our place in it. And then, as I said yesterday, we began to say, well, look, what if there is no God? What if there is no overarching story about our place in this world and our sense of meaning within it? What if my life doesn't have a purpose and I'm just a random collection of cells? As we begin to pull apart in our more secular age our sense of meaning, what if there is no life after death? What if every human life doesn't have the same level of value and dignity and worth? The meaning crisis of our secular age. But we're also in a kind of relationship crisis in this moment. The blue blocks represent the kind of communal stories that hold us together. We're part of families and extended families and communities that we have these relationships with. But again, we've begun to push against some of those relational ties. We've begun to say, well, it's more about me as an individual, and nobody else gets to tell me who I am, what I have to do, how I need to live my life, or how to play a game of Jenga correctly. Whoa, look at this. I've got a challenge. Right, I'm going there. It's slightly cheating if you're a technical Jenga player. Jeremy asked me, has this ever fallen down? And I said, no, not yet. So we begin removing the kind of ties and obligations that we have to one another, the duties to look after and to care for one another. We kind of resist those and push back on them as a society. We say, it's about me. My parents, my school, my religion doesn't get to tell me who I am. And we're in a more consumer society. Even when it comes to death, there's talk about death pods, people beginning to market these ideas. And I choose to live in a little place called Port Stewart. It's the most beautiful place in the world, in my opinion. Very close to Port Rush, which is about to host the Open. I'm just a side job for the tourist board in Northern Ireland. But Stonewall, when they were campaigning for gay marriage, made the point that the government would need to put extra resource around this because who looks after you when you're old, your spouse and your children? And what's reality for gay couples? They were less stable and less likely to be together, and they don't naturally have children. So nobody was going to look after them. So they pointed this out in their own research paper, but then said, and so the government will need to put more money behind this. Because here's the reality, it's relationships that allow our society to function. We look after each other, we have these kind of relationships. And as we resist those ties and we push against them, we have a more lonely society, we've seen the stats go through the roof, we have less people to care for one another. So we have a meaning crisis, a relationship crisis, and then a truth crisis. We're in a much more postmodern world where we don't talk about truth in the same way. We use language of assisted dying and not suicide. And people push back and get very irate when I say this is assisted suicide. They say, well, it's not, it's assisted dying. I say, well, no, it's not about a doctor taking your life. It's about you being able to take your own life. The doctor will give you the pill and you must take it. It's a suicide legislation that's being changed behind the scenes. But in our truth crisis, what we find is, Don, would you mind? I think there's water over there. Is that we have a whole series of micro stories. Each of us has our own truths. Jeremy has his truth, I have my truth. And so we're in a world where we don't have an objective truth, the truth that we talk about. Everybody just has their personal truth bumping into one another. And so we reframe conversation, we change language around it all the time. And we deconstruct and tear apart some of the norms even of language and begin to pull these things apart. Thank you so much. And where we find ourselves then is at the top of this tower is in a kind of permanent state of crisis. So if you played the game of Jenga, the blocks get mixed up. They're not put on as well. They're getting a little bit mixed up at the top. And we are in this very contested kind of space. Some of the things that are in that are interesting. There's an incoherence. We were just talking over breakfast. There was one MP who was campaigning ardently in favor of decriminalization and allowing abortion up to birth, but was also campaigning that 3 days later ardently against assisted suicide. That seemed to me totally incoherent. And you get that again and again. People hold entirely what I would say is contradictory views. They don't even see the incoherence. There's a contested nature of it. It's all mixed up. It's exhausting. It's kind of overwhelming. You've got these two votes falling within 3 days of each other. And we feel that. So if you've ever played the game of Jenga, you reach that point where people take out a few more blocks, and we're almost like, oh, don't touch that block. Don't go near the table. Don't even touch. The whole thing's just about to fall, and it feels like the whole tower, you see it wobbling even there. That's the way we are as a culture at large at this moment. It feels like the cultural stories, the kind of larger story of who we are as a culture, isn't cutting it anymore. It can't sustain the kind of pressure we're putting on it. Everybody's kind of on edge going, I don't know what's going to happen next. This is crazy. And that feeling is being replicated all over the place. And one of the questions is, what is coming next? What is this age that we're moving into? Some people talk almost like a post-human age, where human beings are no longer the center of the conversation, where we can use technology to move beyond the limitations of our body. We can upload our brains into the cloud and then download them into another future robotic body or a different kind of sentient being. Is it even important to be sentient? What does that mean to be embodied? Could our consciousness live on in some other shape and form? And so we're moving into these really interesting conversations. Others are talking about escaping this planet because human beings are almost like a parasite who are ruining the creation and the climate that we have. We're the problem, so we should escape here a small bunch and go to Mars and start a new life somewhere else, a post-human kind of world where human beings are not the most important thing. And so we're saying the cultural stories are really struggling in this moment. And people are like, this doesn't make sense. This isn't working for us. And so what's our response as Christians into that when we look at the kind of larger frame before we get down in the issues? Well, again, yesterday we did turn to Psalm 8. Lord, O Lord, how majestic is your name throughout the earth. You have made your glory higher than the heavens. What are human beings that you think about them? What are human beings that you pay attention to them? You've made them a little lower than God. You have crowned them with glory and honor. You know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and we read the story unfolding. It was good, it was good, it was good, it was good, it was good. And then we have the creation of human beings in his image and in his likeness, and it was very good. It's this incredible language that we are his representatives. We are his image bearers. What is an image bearer? It's almost like the same language for an idol. We're the only legitimate idol, the only thing that carries the image of God, that represents God into creation. Every single human being is made in the image of God. It's this incredible moment that gives us dignity and value and worth in the conversation. If we click on, who are we? Well, every single human being is a divine image bearer. Where are we? We're living in God's good and wonderful and beautiful creation. But the reality is, what has gone wrong is that the world is worshiping idols. We don't like to state it that bluntly, but they have replaced God with something else, often themselves or a different cultural story. And the problem is that if we are, at our core, divine image bearers, made in the image of God, and we deny the God in whose image we are made, what we end up doing is dehumanizing other people. Because we no longer see them as a divine image bearer, so we think we can do with them as we please. They're not as important. They don't have the same value and dignity and worth. What's our cultural story? They are a random collection of cells who have evolved into this being, and when they die, those cells will just fizzle down into the ground. Scientists can help me out here, and then kind of just grow up into a flower or something later. That my dad was nothing more than a random collection of cells, that my relationship to him was a quirky chemical reaction, that there was nothing more to it than that. Now, nobody likes to say that's the story they're living in, but that is the evolutionary story of our world. We are offering an alternative that says, no, you're made in the image of God. And the reason we find this all so jarring is because when you deny God, we dehumanize other people. That's the problem in the world. And the solution, of course, is found in Jesus, but also in finding ourselves within this story. So people have found little fragments of a fractured or shattered mirror, or mirror, as I would like to say, but a reflective object, if you're not following me. And it's like the God story has been shattered and broken, and people are grabbing little fragments of it. They see glimmers of the truth because we are living in God's good creation. They're seeing little glimpses of something and grabbing it, and they see a partial reflection, a partial truth. But as they grab it more tightly, it actually cuts them because it's sharp, because until it's placed back into the fuller story and they understand their place within the larger biblical narrative, they're only grabbing a fragment that will actually hurt and cut them. And it's rarely been so chaotic, but I would say there's rarely been such an exciting time to tell a different story. And assisted suicide, I think, is one of the most interesting places to have a conversation. We did a survey amongst our members, and 60% had a conversation with a non-Christian in the last 3 months at that stage about this topic. Because it's live, and people are kind of going, oh, actually, death is one of those jarring moments, whether your own death or somebody else's, where you have that pause. When my dad was dying, people would say one of three things. I'm praying for him. And they were Christian, and they meant it, and they were. The second group said them praying for him because they knew that was the right thing to say to somebody like me. And I would say, oh, really? What are you praying? And my wife told me to behave myself and be a little more pastoral. But I would have fun. And then the third group would kind of be like, wishing you well, thinking of you. And even as they said it, you could feel the hollowness. I think they knew there was a hollowness. What else do you say? I don't think there's any future for your dad. I don't know what else to say. And there's an emptiness in that moment. But that is also a space for really interesting, deep, and profound conversation. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Dawn, because we're going to look at two parts of that conversation. Dawn's going to look at the end of life at the beginning of life, and then I'm going to come back and look more at the assisted suicide conversation that's been going on in Parliament.
Thanks, Peter. At this point, I know that this is a really big subject. And so again, I know it's already been said, but I don't know what anybody's background is or their personal story. I don't know what decisions have been taken in the context of a fetal diagnosis of a disability or a life-limiting condition. So I want to state that now, and nothing that I say is meant to cause offence. For the purposes of this talk, we can't possibly say everything either, and I do want to point out the booklet. There are a batch here at the front, there's some more at the back if you didn't get one yesterday, or indeed if you did, if you'd like to take a few more to share. And on pages 11 and 12, we talk specifically about abortion for disability and or life-limiting conditions. So in the context of this conversation today, which is looking at the end of life, and we're looking at the end of life at the beginning of life with some of our tiniest family members, we do want to think about what I said yesterday, that both lives in pregnancy always matter. We talked about God's heart for both lives from conception, given the context of his own unborn human story that began at conception. We know that Jesus lived a life from that point of conception of service and vulnerability and submission. How do we take those concepts and that stated objective truth that both lives in pregnancy matter to God when we're talking about the context of a fetal diagnosis? Does that truth stand objectively? How do we respond pastorally and relationally? Kristen Geddes, or the Geddes song, In Christ Alone, Kristen said to me that if she could change one thing about that song, it would be the line, from life's first cry to final breath, Jesus commands our destiny. Now, she didn't like to say what she would change it to. I'm suggesting right now that we potentially could change it to from life's first spark or light, because actually, scientifically, at conception, there's a spark of light. And it's from life's first spark to final breath, Jesus commands our destiny, or does he? Do we take that into our own hands when faced with a diagnosis of disability or a life-limiting condition pre-birth? Borrowing Peter's language of crisis points, there's a crisis of truth that we're faced with. Does every life really matter? And we also know the truth that we live in a broken world. So the circumstances of life, actually post-birth, living with disability and severe needs, can be very challenging. But does the truth still matter? We live in a crisis of relationship. When that diagnosis is given, the language that we've heard from parents who've received it is one of immediate shock, fear about the outcome, fear about the potential suffering during the pregnancy, during the birth even, post-pregnancy. There's disassociation immediately. One mummy said, actually, all of a sudden she felt disassociated from the baby that up until that point she had felt very much connected to. She was struggling to still see her baby as her baby, because all she could hear and all the medics were giving her was the language around a diagnosis. The relationship with medical teams can be broken, because immediately babies become fetuses with a condition. And trust can break down between parents and medics, and we'll come on to that. There's a crisis of circumstances overall. As I said, we live within the context of a broken health and social care system, and within the context of very often broken, dysfunctional families. What is the reality of living with disability and maybe complex needs post-birth? And indeed, through the remaining weeks of pregnancy, where is the support? Where is the support network? In one respect, all induced abortions could be classed as assisted dying. because without that induced termination, that little tiny life would continue until natural death at some point. But certainly when there are terminations for medical reasons, we see a very close parallel to current arguments supporting the assisted suicide or assisted dying bill. The fear of suffering, the desire to avoid suffering, the desire to respond with compassion. And in pregnancy, that must mean mummy, daddy, wider family, and baby. So we're talking about layers of suffering and the desire to respond with compassion. But do we live in a system that has dehumanized those unborn babies in a way that actually has brought us to the point where in law they immediately become subcategorized as less worthy? We certainly live within a culture where most of those babies are terminated. Why is that? Law shapes culture. In 2022, the most recent figures for abortion, in England and Wales, there were 3,124 abortions performed under Ground E. Ground E is the legal defence for abortion when there is a substantial risk that if the child were born, it would suffer from such physical or mental abnormalities as to be seriously handicapped. Now, that legislation provides for the termination of life at any stage of pregnancy up to birth. For an able-bodied baby, the limit is capped at viability, 22, 24 weeks. So the law that we have is inherently discriminatory. It's prenatal disability discrimination. In that same year, 2022, there were around 800 abortions from the point of 22 weeks of pregnancy under Ground E. Now, it's a tiny number given the whole, which was over 250,000. But those are 800 lives, 800 mothers and fathers and families who are left mourning and grieving. And then the whole, the 3,000. It's a significant number. How do we respond? As I said, I invite you to read the booklet. But when I was thinking about what I would bring to this, I thought what I would do is look to the voices of the people who live this or have lived this. I'm very aware that it's very easy for me to be put into a pro-life activist box. And so often, it's not my voice or the voice of our campaign or initiative that we want to be heard. We want to bring God's voice into the story, but it's the voices of the women who've been impacted or the individuals. We had a graduate intern a couple of years ago who has achondroplasia, dwarfism, if that's not, I think I can still, that's appropriate. He said in the classroom one day in school, his teacher had been explaining some of the reasons women may choose to have an abortion. And she explained that abortion in circumstances where the mother's health or life were at risk and in the difficult circumstance of rape. Then she went on to talk about disability. And he says, "I wasn't prepared for what came next. She turned to me, 'Andrew, to use your disability as an example, you may have been aborted.' I stared at her in disbelief. I couldn't believe that she'd used my disability as the example. I was angry and confused. She didn't know what my life was like. She wasn't qualified to make a comment like that. My teacher didn't mean to offend me, but her comment was deeply damaging because abortion sends a discriminatory message of disability prevention." Many who support abortion for those reasons don't think about the fact that it's discrimination. But it sends that message. The Committee for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women in Parliament said in 2019 that abortion should be provided for disability without perpetuating stereotypes towards people living with disabilities. And he asked, how's that possible? It's a significantly demoralizing message and a dehumanizing message. And that's what he heard it as. If we look at the context of a life-limiting condition being diagnosed before birth, on our website, all these are on our website, Hannah is the name of the young woman who came to us after looking at our Mary Said Yes devotional resource and said, as part of her decision making, Mary's yes to her pregnancy helped her to say yes to the pregnancy that she was living with in the context of having received a diagnosis that her baby would not live, potentially to birth. And in her words, she wrote this letter to other parents, and she said, "Trusting God has never felt more real to me than it does now. If this is what you're experiencing, He is the one holding your baby when you no longer can. I trust Him completely with the care of this baby, knowing He's caring for him with love and safety. Here, now, and until I can join them in heaven. If you're a believer, you have the assurance of that eternal life in heaven when your time here is done and your baby will be waiting for you there. But because God is good, He created something beautiful within pregnancy, a profound detail that connects you to your baby forever. It's called fetal maternal chimerism, meaning your baby's DNA will live in your body for the rest of your life. It's far from easy. Some days you may wonder if you'll survive it, but through the hope and strength of Jesus, you will. And just like Hannah, who prayed for years for her baby, and then God blessed her with a son, and then she did something remarkable in giving him back to God, this young woman chose to do the same thing. When her baby received that diagnosis, she relinquished control of his life and the life that she thought she would have with him to God. Now, I know, and as Peter has said, if you don't have a faith, what do you do with that? You can't maybe have that same reaction and principle to stand on. But for us as Christians, just as I come to a conclusion, what do we do with this? And I'm not here, and I'm sorry if you thought it would be, to give you answers necessarily. But as I look out at you, I see parents and grandparents who can support those within their own family and churches who are receiving a diagnosis, who can send that message of life, live that message of life, up to the birth and post-birth. What does it look like as church to support those living with significant needs? It's very easy to say we trust women to choose abortion. It doesn't cost us anything to support them in their lived experience. In front of me are teachers who can think about language in class within the context of curriculums and social change, and medics, nurses, midwives, doctors, who can think about perinatal palliative care that starts pre-birth, that includes and wraps around mummy and baby throughout their maybe short life journey together. And we have policy makers. We know we have someone who was sitting in the House of Lords. Every person in this room has a part to play as we wrestle with the tensions that we hold, the truth that both lives matter, and the reality of the termination of life and the prevalence of that, because you are proportionally most at risk of being terminated preborn if you're sick or disabled. As church, we have a better message to bring and a better culture to model that we don't always do. I just heard yesterday from somebody who works in the disability space that every week she hears from two families who've been asked to leave their church, or it's made impossible for them to stay because their needs as a family aren't being met. There's a lot of solutions that we can find. We need to ask the questions and wrestle with them.
Thanks, Dawn. So we've looked at some of the stories, and this, again, as we've said, is really difficult territory. I want to look now a little bit at some of the arguments that are being used. How do we engage with confidence in what is being said in our culture around these issues? The kind of language that tends to be used is my death, my choice, that this is the compassionate thing to do. And some are even bold enough to talk about the costs, the cost savings. So I want to look at control, choice, compassion, and cost. That's if you like your structure. There's four C's there for you coming up. So we're going to look at control first of all. Control. My death is the kind of chant that's there. So I should be in control. And why is it my death? Just to state the obvious, because it's my body is the argument in our culture. It's an argument rooted essentially in ownership or property. We have a lack of meaning, I would say, down to the bottom of my favorite Jenga tower in our kind of secular age. And so the argument is, there's nothing beyond this. There's no greater purpose to my life, so I own my body. But once you grant the idea that a body can be owned, you need to think very carefully about the consequences of that, is what I would say to some of my opponents who use that language. We have seen what happens when someone else can own our bodies, the history of slavery. We have seen when the state makes claims over our bodies. What about the market? Is there a future in which you can trade your body or parts of your bodies? Do we want to grant the basic position that our bodies can be owned in any way, shape, or form, even by ourselves? Because that's the basis of that claim. My body, it's something that I own and I determine. What would we say in response to that as Christians? My only comfort in life and death is that I am not my own, but belong in body and soul to Jesus Christ. So begins the 17th century Heidelberg Catechism. To 21st century supporters of assisted suicide, few lines could seem more alien. Their creed says the opposite. My comfort is that my life is my own, my death is up to me. But interestingly, those lines were actually quoted by a guy called James Eglinton, a professor of theology in Edinburgh, in an article in the Times that he wrote around this topic. You see, Christian ethics and theology is rooted in personhood, not property. That life is a gift, that God is the giver, and that we are invited into relationship with the giver of all life. And the other pathway, as we know, is to reject the giver, that we take control. It's a going back to Genesis 3. Did God really say, essentially, is God good? Can God be trusted? And the answer, essentially, some of our culture is saying is, well, no, we can't, so I want to take control of my own body. I want to determine my own death at a point of my choosing. But that rejection of God is not just at a personal level. It has society-wide implications. Tom Holland wrote a book called Dominion, some of you might have heard of it, in which he makes the case that Christianity gave us our sense of dignity, our sense of value, our ideas around equality and rights. That every human being has dignity is a specifically Christian concept because all are made in the image of God. That we have equality and that everybody has it, again, is because everybody is a divine image bearer. And the kind of narrative that we have around rights is largely built upon Christian thinking. And that's the kind of core thesis of Tom Holland's book. As an agnostic historian, he looks back and goes, well, without Christianity, we wouldn't have any of these things. So as we claim, as our culture, pushes back on that, there are implications. The ownership model is a very limiting model, whereas Christianity has granted people personhood and a dignity that flows from that. The sanctity of life comes from that. That every human being is sacred because we're made in the image of God. That only God, therefore, has authority to give and to take life, to intentionally end another's life, even one's own, is ultimately to usurp God's sovereignty and authority in that moment. Psalm 139, it's God who forms us in the womb, we know it well, but he also knows our days, we're reminded. In Job, the Lord gave, the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Even the prohibition against killing, you shall not kill, clearly includes, I would say, self-killing and any kind of assisted killing. If we are to help somebody in ending their life, even with their consent, we are breaching that commandment because we are taking control of what is not ours to take control of. So we live in a culture that wants to control, but there are implications that it narrows and limits the importance of the body and who we are as human beings to an ownable commodity, I would say. It's the natural consequence of that line of thinking, whereas we're articulating something much grander, much better, that you're a person with dignity and value and worth, but there are implications of that too. We are not our own to do with as we please. The control argument. The second argument is my death, my choice, the choice argument. Again, we live in an age of profound individualism. If we've cast off God, if we've cast off any kind of transcendent authority, who's in charge? I am. It's my choice. It's my body, so it's my choice. My body, my death, my choice as to how it happens, when it happens, and it's all about what's best for me. Because again, relationships have been pushed down and made secondary in this moment. And we see it very clearly in this legislation. You don't have to consult with a spouse, with siblings, with children. They don't get a say in this if the person wants to end their own life. They're not consulted and they're not engaged. Healthcare professionals, their views are kind of relegated down. Even the impact on wider society all become runners up to my freedom and my choice in this moment. And the battle really is between, I would say, freedom and coercion. Freedom here, for the campaigners who want this, is not just to do as they please, but to ensure that others are obliged to carry out their wishes. This isn't just a freedom to end your own life. Ultimately, you have that freedom. Yes, there's a suicide act that would punish you after you attempt, you know, that's. But fundamentally, this is about requiring medics, requiring others to help you end your life. So freedom is immediately obliging other people. Not only that, it requires the law to be changed. And then when you change law, you begin to change the culture around it. So this individual personal freedom has consequences across society. And I think the biggest counter-argument to this is around coercion and the risk of coercion. Our belief and choice is so strong that as a culture, we are prepared to ignore the realities of coercion. In fact, Kim Leadbeater was so troubled, I think, by this argument, the proposer of the bill, that she started to talk about families coercing relatives to stay alive. She actually made a statement in the House to that effect. She said, the danger is that you're coercing people to keep on living. Because the coercion argument is probably the one that they're most vulnerable upon. Because at your most psychologically vulnerable moment, we are told we have a choice. You've just been given a diagnosis, and to get under this legislation, it has to be that you have less than 6 months to live. And at that point, suffering, using up NHS resources, the risk of being a burden are put on the table, and there's this other option to do the right thing. There's another way. Some say coercion is just irrelevant. Choice is so important, it doesn't matter if some are coerced. Others say, yes, we know it's a risk, but we can deal with that risk. We can regulate, and we can put guidelines, and we can put all sorts of things in place. But everything they put in place, they kind of tore down. We'll put a judge in place, it'd be fine, it'll be a high court judge, the highest bar possible. And the high court judge has said, no, don't come near us, thank you very much. Then this panel, and then we changed the nature of the panel, and then we kept changing the competency test to get in under the panel. Because coercion is incredibly difficult to spot. We know that from all sorts of other pieces of legislation. It's subtle. Almost nobody is going to go and say, right, granny, your time's up, it's time for you to go. It doesn't happen like that. It's subtle, it's implicit, it's rarely stated. But this conversation will be on the table for anybody who gets a diagnosis, a terminal diagnosis. It changes the nature of every conversation. And the risk of coercion is not something easily dealt with through regulation. So we've got control, we've got choice, and then compassion. Because who doesn't want to be compassionate? The argument is this is the compassionate thing to do, to allow people to be assisted in ending their lives. And how could you stand in the way of compassion? I would say we're in this bit here. We're playing the postmodern game. This is linguistic gymnastics going on here. Is it about compassion? Is it really? It's really a conversation about the role of suffering and the reality of suffering in our lives. We don't want to suffer because we've been promised a good life. Eudaimonia is what the ethical philosophers talk about. Happiness. The greatest happiness to the greatest number of people is our kind of driving ethical philosophy in this moment. And so as a culture, we have very little lens, I would say no lens, really, on what to do with suffering. Suffering is something to be avoided, and if you can't avoid it, to be ended. And if you can't end it, will you end the life of the sufferer? Bluntly, is the argument that's unfolding there. If you can't live a happy life, why would you go on? We have no lens to deal with that. So we use this language of compassion, even though compassion means to suffer with. Com or co-passion, to suffer, passion's to suffer, and then the co or the com is to suffer alongside or to suffer with. To go through the suffering, to alleviate the suffering, to journey it together with others. And so instead we try and avoid it, and if we can't avoid it, we eliminate the sufferer. Again, that's a blunt stating of my opponent's case, but I think that's the reality of where their argument leads. Assisted suicide risks suggesting that a life of suffering, a life with disability, as Don was talking about, is somehow not worth living. And you've seen disability campaigners saying, we've been excluded from the entire conversation because nobody wants to deal with that reality, that somehow they can have a fulfilling life even though it appears to some to be less than complete. And we also know as Christians, Romans 5, suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope. You know, in 2 Corinthians, God's power is made perfect in weakness. Right at the core of our story is a moment where Jesus comes down and suffers with and suffers for us. There is redemptive suffering in the gospel story. We do have a lens on suffering. We do have a lens into that conversation. When our culture just says, we don't know what to do with suffering, so let's just get rid of it. We're like, actually, suffering's a part of life. There's a reality to it. Now, there's lots to be said beneath that. There's lots to be said around that. We need to be careful how we articulate that. But compassion is being misused in this conversation, and we need to be okay to call it out and say, no, we suffer with. It's the tough journey of Jeremy with his dad. It's the tough journey of me with my own dad and with my mother-in-law. Tough journey that many of you have gone through. That's not easy territory, but it's important ground to go through. And finally, cost. Because yes, some are actually bold enough to talk about the cost, because there are massive cost implications to this conversation. Kit Malthouse was the second MP alongside Kim Leadbeater proposing and seconding a lot of legislation. He came closest to acknowledging that basically there was going to be huge cost savings if we do this. I mean, he's technically right, because they had to do impact assessments. The cost of providing this service is X, and the savings of providing this service is Y, and they will significantly outweigh it over time, because the cost of ending a life is relatively small, and the cost of continuing in some of these situations is relatively high. And the reality is that 27% of hospice care in the UK is funded by government, and the rest is privately funded or charitably funded. The government doesn't fund current hospice care. It doesn't do it well. And so bluntly put, it is cheaper to assist somebody in ending their own lives than to offer proper palliative care. And there was an underlying bubbling argument that just came close to the surface a few times around that, because this bill commits the government to funding, and by the government I mean us as taxpayers, to funding an assisted suicide service, but does not commit it to funding proper palliative care. Wes Streeting, the health secretary, who's opposed to this, was very clear about that. There would be implications, there would be cuts elsewhere to fund this service. And so in conclusion, I think this is a really problematic piece of legislation, but I also think, as I said earlier, it's an interesting area of conversation. 60% of the people who responded to our survey said they had talked about it with somebody else. It's a space of a slightly different conversation. I'm slightly unusual. I'm very happy and quite enjoy talking about some of these issues like abortion and trans and same-sex marriage and in my life. And my kids are think I'm slightly weird on that. But like the reality is that an assisted suicide, actually, that's one that does touch everybody. And there's a slightly different frame as you enter that conversation. There's a pastoral element. This isn't about winning an argument, just to be clear. This is about sitting with people for whom it just takes us to a profound conversation that we rarely seem to have anymore in our culture. Where people are like, actually, yeah, I had somebody went through that. I have a relative or a parent who's close to that. And suddenly we're like, so what is death? What happens after life? Who's doing the funeral? What does that look like for you as a family to care for them and support them? And you enter a much deeper level of conversation. But I think we should have confidence to engage in some of these issues. This legislation, I believe, is absolutely wrong in principle. It undermines the dignity and the value and the worth of every single human being, particularly the most marginalized in our society, those with disability and those who are elderly. They're the most likely, if we flick to the last slide. So it's wrong in principle. It's wrong at a policy level. It's just badly written law. Said it was going to have judges. No, it doesn't. Won't allow an opt-out for care homes and hospices. That means if you have a care home or hospice, no care home or no hospice can opt out of the whole system. So there's no safe place where you can say, we are in this care home or this group of care homes and they will never offer this service. They're not allowed to do that. They just rejected any amendments that would allow that. There's lack of clarity on the drugs being used. There's no proper competency tests on the way in that would be normal things. There's lots of capacity kind of issues. And Canada shows us where this leads. I studied in Canada, did my theology there. I have lots of friends who minister there. 5% of all deaths in Canada are under what they call their MAID legislation. 5% of all deaths are assisted suicide in Canada. When you get any kind of diagnosis in Canada, this becomes a live conversation. It's what my ministry friends say. It frames everything. Even if it's to take it off the table, it automatically comes on, and anybody can bring it on. A family member, a medic, somebody comes along and says, have you thought about this option? And you're constantly, no. As in, we've thought about it and we're declining it, but it's still there the whole time and it's beginning to frame the mindset. This is an option. Should you be thinking about it? Why do people keep raising this with me? It's a reframe of our entire understanding. It's bad in principle and in policy. It's a bad process. It was a private member's bill. Didn't get proper scrutiny. It's now going to the House of Lords. So it's passed the House of Commons. The House of Lords will almost certainly try and change it. They might wreck it. They might vote it down. in all likelihood, they will sort of fix it, for want of a better phrase. They will try and correct some of the worst bits of it. But they are torn as to what they should do in this moment. But I do think we are well placed to have pastoral conversations. And this is one of the places that the church does show up, in chaplaincy and in hospitals, around funerals and around some of the most difficult conversations. We have, if you like, skin in the game in equity. It's one of the places people say, yeah, well, you guys are there, to be fair. You're entitled to be in this conversation. And we should be, and with confidence enter the conversation. This isn't easy. And one of the reasons I go back to the Jenga blocks is we're trying to say, how do you frame this as you look at a conversation that might be around abortion, that might be around assisted suicide, that might be around the trans conversation, or it might be around AI, it might be around any of these topics. We start to look back at the cultural story and say, let's hold up a mirror to the culture and say, I don't think your story's cutting it anymore. Let's begin to just kind of look at their story and begin to see that it's way less solid than it appears. I want to suggest that across the board, the cultural story is weaker than we think, and the God story is stronger than we sometimes act. We're lacking confidence in a story that we already know the outcome, we already know it's victorious, if you like, but it's a stronger, more consistent, more coherent story, and the cultural story that we're getting immersed in all the time in our schools and colleges and media and all is actually much weaker than it appears. It's incredibly vulnerable. It's falling apart. It's always been the case, but I think others are beginning to spot it now too. It isn't easy, but I do think the fields are wide on to harvest. And here's what the interesting thing is. The missional conversations are happening in some of the most strange places, like abortion, like assisted suicide, like the trans conversation, where our culture at large is recognizing that biological, or I would say creational reality, is cutting it. And they're like, oh, actually, yeah, we've got a problem. And so I think we're in a really great space to have some of these conversations. One of the things we're passionate about as EA on the last slide is to help resource you in that. The Being Human Project is one of the ways in which we do that. We have a podcast and we have some small group resources. Those are all freely available and you can check those out to try and help us navigate some of the conversations that we're having in this moment. And with that, I'm going to hand over to Jeremy, or I'm going to stay here, and he's going to go roving with a microphone. If you have any questions, the hard ones are for Dawn, the easy ones are for me.
Good. A question here already.
Thinking of what Kim Ledbetter has done and the reasons for it, looking at the extreme cases, such as someone who's in screaming agony that morphine can't overcome and then says, I don't want to carry on like this, I want this to end. In that particular area, I think they have a strong case to say, well, what can you do for this person?
Yeah, I understand that. Like the association, I hear that. The Association of Palliative Medicine, I think that's the right name for them. I think it's 80% of their members are opposed to this because these are the people who provide palliative care and say, look, those are either exceptionally rare or almost unheard. I'm not saying there are none of those, but their ability to manage pain and what they can do is incredible what they can do. What they're saying is we don't have all the resource to do that and to do that well. So there's two things I would say. One, hard cases make bad law, a famous kind of legal maxim. So you need to be really careful you don't frame all your law around those one or two incredibly difficult cases. And also those cases are rarer than I think were portrayed in the debate. That's why the palliative care medics are saying, actually, we're very good at our jobs and know how to do this and manage pain really well. And if we do palliative care well, you can die well. And that's right and good. And there are tricky conversations around how we understand all of that. But fundamentally, they do that job well. And that's why they're opposed to this, because their fear is this widens the doorway just way wider and is using those cases in an unhelpful way, I would say.
Thanks. I graduated from uni a couple of years ago, and in final year, like in Scotland, it's 5 years, it's hard course. And my friend had an abortion in final year, and there was nothing, she was getting it. And she was like, can you be my emergency contact? And I was like, yeah, of course, because I want to be there, I want to look after mom. But also, like, I wept for days, because that's like one of my closest friends. I felt like that was going to be my nephew or my niece. Like, what do you do in these situations where you have non-Christian friends, but Dawn, you want to bring Jesus into that situation? It's a really tricky one.
Sorry, I couldn't see where you were. Thank you. And I think just really quickly, I would say you're still her friend. You can't undo, as you said, you're grieving. And I suspect at some level she is or will be grieving. And many of the stories on her website, it could be decades later, but then the pain bubbles up. So I would say two things. Keep supporting her. Point her to those, if she indeed is expressing pain, point her to professional support. And there are counsellors, including faith-based recovery, post-abortion recovery programmes. Some of those are listed on our website. Have those details to hand. And maybe just connecting that to what Peter's been talking about. We did a talk one time where a palliative care nurse was expressing that there was a patient she had who had uncontrollable pain all of a sudden, and they couldn't get it under control, couldn't understand what it was, and it was psychosomatic, if that's the right word. She'd had an abortion years before and had never told anyone. And the grief of that at her point of death was apparent. When she then told her family, the palliative care nurse said they got her pain back under control. So it's not simple, but I would say those clear things, it's be her friend, point her to where there are professional supports, pray for her, and we know that at some point that pain may come out, so she's going to need your support.
One of the things you haven't mentioned is that terminal prognoses are often not accurate. Back in 1992, I prayed at the bedside of someone that I thought I'd never see again. She'd be given a terminal diagnosis of leukemia, and she's still alive today. And if this law had been in, she had the option to end her life, and she would have had her husband still alive, her children are still alive, and she would have been denied, and the family, all those relationships.
I mean, absolutely, and amen to it. I think this is one of the places where we have that a very different narrative to both pray into, to support, to see that, and to be around. So I just think we're in a culture driven by fear, fundamentally, in so many of the decisions that are going on right now. It's a fear-driven narrative, and we are people of hope. So one of the things I would say is we have to be really careful not to fall into that fear narrative. We fear God and nothing else. We need to be really careful, and we should be people of hope in these conversations. And there is some irony that the main advocate or the original advocate for this, Esther Runson, is still alive because treatments have come about because she couldn't have ended her life when she could. So she's survived and has lived much longer than was originally anticipated for that very reason. A new treatment came along and she is under that new treatment regime. So I totally agree with you on the diagnosis bit. So if I had longer, I'd give you a whole list of other things. But that's one of the hardest things. Almost nobody can agree when a six-month diagnosis is and what that looks like. And then in Canada, we've seen how that's extended then to mental health, to depression, to inability to pay for healthcare, and then inability to pay for housing. So they've just continually broadened and broadened and broadened the ground. So the slippery slope argument is very real, and we have the evidence for it.
Yes, I brought up in the Muslim country, and I don't think this bill will pass in that Muslim country. Then I move here, and with this progress, in my personal opinion, I don't think we can stop it. Even though we are as a Christian, we shout it loud because it's a matter of politician, right? And I'm not pro that one because I'm not pro of this thing. As my daughter also work in the NHS, but I think as a Christian now we became a minority, and I just want to ask your question, your advice. What can we do if in the situation that we cannot change things?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things on that. I mean, Shabana Mahmood, interestingly, the Justice Secretary as a Muslim, was one of the most outspoken and clear that it was her Muslim faith driving her, and actually I think encouraged some others to be a bit clearer about that faith articulation. Her clarity was better than some Christians. People encouraged, come on, be clear the reasons. I think whether this bill gets changed or amended in the Lords, and that there's a whole debate around that, whether it will absolutely pass, but I agree it's on that trajectory, no doubt. But I think Our hope is not solely in the law, so we campaign and advocate for that when we can. But even when law changes, then we are absolutely trying to work within that. So we can be people of hope. We can be people offering pastoral care within that. You have conscience opt-outs if you're right in the NHS and asked to do this. We already know they're likely to really struggle to provide, to find enough providers or people prepared to do this because so many doctors don't want to. And I think there's different ways and people can take a stand around that. But I think more largely then, we are in a cultural moment where, and again, I said a little bit this yesterday, but I want to say it again, I think it's a really fascinating time to be alive and to be a Christian in this moment. So I think we've seen a little tilt around this. So the Quiet Revival report that some of you might have heard a little bit about, what that showed is an uptick in church attendance in England and Wales of close to 50%. Now, I know I've talked to a lot of people, not everybody's experiencing that, but there's certain categories that was really interesting. So amongst young people, it was the most significant uptick. And we are hearing a lot of stories that would substantiate that. And this was a survey of 17,000 people. YouGov, the biggest polling company, we're saying particularly amongst men, it went from 4% to 16%. So things that we have been praying for is to see more young people and particularly more young men, and they have been responding. And we are hearing both the stories and the stats. We've seen a number of surveys validate that. I think it's interesting that in this moment, that's happening. So as culture struggles more and more to answer the profound questions of life, people are turning elsewhere. Now, I'm not saying they're all immediately turning to Christianity, but there's an increased interest in faith across the board, an increase in the transcendent. And there's two ways they're going. One, to a more kind of orthodox, as in literally the Orthodox Church, the Catholic Church, and a more kind of orthodox, liturgical, structured sort of religion, or a more experiential, so more charismatic Pentecostal. They want one of those two things. They want order. It's the kind of Peterson chaos out of order thing. They're looking for that. This is the God who spoke order out of chaos and formed the world out of the tohu vahu, the chaos. Or they want life. They want a kind of experiential life. And of course, Jesus promises that too. I've come that you might have life and have it to the full. So I think we are really well positioned to engage in this conversation. Now, I'm not saying everybody's seeing that, but if you look at the statistics right across the UK, and actually we're hearing now more and more of this trend globally, there is something going on. There's a renewed interest. Tomorrow, I'm in conversation down in London and Westminster with policymakers around Christian nationalism. Why is he mentioning that tangent? Because the policymakers are saying, is there a rise in Christian nationalism? And why are some parties and some political people talking about a return to Christian values? Now, there's a whole lot of questions around that. But what's interesting is politicians are savvy. They do what's popular. Why are they saying they want to return to Christian values? Because they think people want it and they think there's an interest in it. One of the things we're saying to main parties is you went secular and people are fed up with that. And so somebody else has realized there's a massive space of people who are interested in Christianity. 48% of the population still say they're Christian. 6 million people, so roughly 10% of the population, are practicing Christians, going to church once a month, praying once a week, reading the Bible once a week. People have said, oh, actually, people are sympathetic to Christianity again. So 5 years ago, you'd have never done that. I find it really interesting that that's a pitch somebody's making. So there is renewed interest. I'm not saying, again, that's across the board for everybody, but what I am saying is there's a space for us to have missional conversations again. What does it mean to be a Christian? Now, in the Christian nationalism, we'll have to do some stuff about sacrifice and submission and some different understanding than some people might have. But what encourages me is there is an appetite and there is an interest, and it's around some of these conversations. Look at how the trans conversation has shifted, and there is an acceptance of biological or creational reality. Mm-hmm. Now, again, J.K. Rowling led that conversation, not so much Christians, and we need to be careful and say, that was good up to a point, but we disagree with you on some other things. But I think it's a healthy conversation. Say, yes, male and female are important. That's part of what it is to be created in the image of God. Let's have a conversation in that space. What do good relationships look like? Let's talk about that in terms of sexuality. So these are the space we get to occupy. My long, nearly preaching rant to you guys, I think it's a really exciting moment. So I want to hold the tension of saying, it's tough. These are hard conversations. But none of my non-Christian friends find these conversations easy either. They do not have an easy answer to any of them. They're struggling with them too. And I suspect that's the case across the board. And we do. Not a simplistic, Jesus is the answer. It's deeper than that. Jesus is the answer, but it's more than that. It's an entire story he's inviting us into, the God story. Mm-hmm. And it's a personal relationship with Jesus, and then it's a community of faith to do life with. And without all those three things, I don't know how many of my non-Christian friends navigate these moments as parents and as teachers and as working professionals. But that's what gives me hope in this moment.